Please stand by for today's conference. It will begin momentarily. During the question and answer session today, you may press star one to ask a question. Again, please stand by. Today's call will begin momentarily. Thank you. Welcome and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the question and answer session today, you may press star 1 to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'll turn the call over to Mr. Tom Skinner. You may begin, sir.
Thank you, Shirley, and thank you, everyone, for joining us for the release of another CDC Vital Signs, this one on overdoses of prescription opioid pain relievers in the United States for the years 1999 to 2008. We're very pleased today to be joined by Mr. Gil Kerlikowski, the Director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy. We also have with us today the Director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Thomas Frieden, and also with us today is a health scientist from the CDC, Dr. Chris Jones. Dr. Frieden is going to provide some opening remarks, then Mr. Kerlikowski, and then we will get to your questions. So without further ado, I'll turn it over to Dr. Frieden.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thanks very much for joining us. This is Dr. Frieden, Director of the CDC. The topic today is about prescription painkiller overdose. And the unfortunate and, in fact, shocking news is that we are in the midst of an epidemic of prescription drug overdose in this country. It's an epidemic, but it can be stopped. 15,000 people died from prescription drug overdose last year. That's about 40 deaths per day from prescription painkillers, also known as prescription opiates, and essentially these are narcotics. Same drug, just different word for the same drug. So narcotics prescribed by physicians kill 40 people a day. The number of deaths has increased threefold in the past decade. And now there are more people killed by prescription narcotics than from heroin and cocaine combined. This reflects a huge increase in the amount of prescription narcotics prescribed by doctors every year. In fact, enough narcotics are prescribed to give every adult in America 1 month of prescription narcotics. As a result of this large number of prescriptions, and there are about one out of every 20 adults who have a history of inappropriately using prescription narcotics. This stems from a few irresponsible doctors, and in fact, now the burden of dangerous drugs is being created more by a few irresponsible doctors than by drug pushers on street corners. There is a fivefold difference in the rate of drug abuse deaths between different states. So state policy can make a huge difference in either controlling or allowing this epidemic to proceed. The costs are substantial. Not only is it 15,000 deaths a year, it's also tens of thousands of emergency department visits, hospitalizations, drug treatments, and an estimated $70 billion a year in health care costs. Prescription painkillers are meant to help people who have severe pain. They are, however, highly addictive. Palliation of pain is a right, and people with chronic pain, such as people with cancer whose pain cannot be relieved otherwise, can benefit enormously from effective pain relief. There are specific things that can be done that can drastically reduce the number of prescription overdoses, of deaths, and of people who become addicted. The first is for states to rigorously monitor who is prescribing and to whom, to identify the doctors and the patients who may have inappropriate patterns of prescription or use, and then to take effective action for those doctors or those patients. One means of taking that effective action is through patient review and restriction policies, which identifies problem patients or patients who have had a problem with drugs and limits them to one doctor to prescribe narcotics and one pharmacy to fill those narcotic prescriptions. States can also take effective action to shut pill mills and reduce doctor shopping by patients. Boards that are concerned with physician licensure can take appropriate action against physicians who have been inappropriate in providing prescription narcotics outside of the bounds of reasonable medical practice. And the healthcare profession can do a better job at improving their practices in prescribing, ensuring that appropriate quantities are prescribed. For example, if someone comes in with acute pain, 3 days rather than 30 days should be the standard. That applies to physicians, dentists, and others who prescribe. For chronic pain, narcotics should be a last resort. There are many other effective ways of palliation of pain. Narcotics are highly addictive. And in emergency departments, more and more emergency department systems around the country are looking at the use of long-acting narcotics and saying that this may not be an appropriate thing to prescribe from the emergency department. It's something that someone should get from their source of ongoing care. For individuals, it's important to know not to start using drugs inappropriately, not to help others to start, and to get help to stop if you are addicted or having trouble with painkillers, narcotics, or prescription opiates. Again, bottom line, we are in the midst of an epidemic of prescription drug overdose from opiates, prescription narcotics. This epidemic can be stopped, and we're optimistic that examples from around the country show that when states get serious about prescription drug overdose, they're able to shut pill mills, they're able to reduce inappropriate prescriptions, and they're able to begin turning the tide on this epidemic. I'm delighted to be joined by Director Gil Kerlikowske from the National Drug Control Policy Office. Director Kerlikowske?
Well, let me thank Dr. Frieden for inviting me here to Atlanta and to the CDC today, and for his commitment in raising awareness in the public health community about this challenge, and more importantly, to raising America's awareness because of the great credibility and trust that people in this country have for the CDC. I also want to take a moment to commend the incredible staff here at CDC who have worked so hard on this. This has truly been a partnership that is going to result in turning this epidemic around. Well, prescription drug abuse is our nation's fastest growing drug problem, and according to my colleagues here, and you've heard Dr. Frieden call it an epidemic, and that's not a word that I or the nation's public health community use lightly. Well, the facts as outlined by Dr. Frieden are truly devastating. He has outlined the troubling trends in the data. Now, I'd like to talk for a few minutes about what we're doing together to address this challenge. When I talk about working together, I'm not talking about just among the federal partners, but really among state and local agencies, which is where a lot of the work is getting done. Well, from day one, the Obama administration has been laser-focused on responding to this crisis, and the CDC could not be a better partner in these efforts. And earlier this year, with the help of our federal partners, we released, it was actually in April, the first comprehensive action plan to combat the national prescription drug abuse epidemic. Well, the plan provides a national framework for reducing prescription drug diversion and abuse by supporting the expansion of the state-based prescription drug monitoring programs, recommending more convenient and environmentally responsible disposal methods to remove unused or unneeded medications from the home, supporting education for patients and healthcare providers, and reducing the prevalence of the pill mills and the doctor shopping efforts through enforcement. We have set a goal of reducing prescription drug abuse by 15% by 2015. And we're also working with Congress to pursue legislative actions that will reduce this epidemic. Already, the President signed into law bipartisan legislation that will make it easier for communities to collect dangerous, unneeded, or expired prescription drugs on their own. And we're working closely as DEA finalizes these rules. To build on the progress, we're working with Congress on legislation that will require those who prescribe certain painkillers to receive education regarding the proper prescribing. Well, let me close by saying that America's prescription drug abuse epidemic is not a problem that's going to be solved overnight. But at the same time, we are clearly not powerless about this. All of us have a role to play, and the most important work clearly happens at the local level. And as we work on an aggressive federal response, I urge every parent to take time today to properly dispose of unneeded or expired medications from their homes, to take time to talk to their kids about the significant harm caused by prescription drug abuse. And with that, I think we're turning it back to Tom.
Okay. Shirley, I believe we're ready for questions, please.
Thank you. We will now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. You will be prompted to record your name. To withdraw your request, you may press star 2. Again, press star 1 to ask a question. And our first question comes from Marion Falco with CNN Medical News. You may ask your question.
Hi. Thanks for taking questions. Mr. Kurlikowski, this isn't the first time, as you mentioned, that we've been hearing about this epidemic. And what's even changed, if anything, since April, since you made your big announcement? There was another report that came out a couple months later. How exactly do you get doctors to not prescribe to multiple, or how do you coordinate so that one doctor is only prescribing these painkillers as opposed to multiple doctors and only one pharmacy dispensing this? I mean, how is this happening in reality? It seems like there's a lot of stuff happening in Washington, but how is it happening in the field?
Well, first, I don't think we're recommending that that patients only be limited to one individual physician, nor do I think we should be in the position of saying that limiting it to a particular pharmacy. And I think that's the beauty of the PDMPs, the prescription drug monitoring plans. We still have two states that have not passed them. We still have a number of states that, even though the law has been passed recently, and the example would be Florida, in which they're not up and running. We also have in those states, even in the states where they are up and running, physicians who are not using them as robustly as we would like to see. And we need to make sure that we are doing everything we can to improve these PDMPs. That will reduce the doctor shopping. That will allow, which the states have the responsibility in regulating the practice of medicine, that will allow the states to identify potential abusers in the medical field. And so I think that what we've also seen is the drug takebacks, and it was recently concluded on Saturday by the Drug Enforcement Administration, the literally what I suspect will be, again, hundreds of thousands of pounds of unused and unneeded prescriptions. So the problem is continuing, and we're hearing a lot about it, but to be joined at the hip today with the CDC on this issue is important for all of us. And those are the things that I see where we're making some progress.
And just to amplify that a little bit, we do think that there are specific instances, for example, patients who have a history of inappropriate use of prescription opiates, where patient review and restriction policies can be cost-saving and life-saving. And Medicaid programs, prescription benefit managers, insurers, and other payers of health care can implement those programs to both save money and save lives.
But
Dr. Frieden, didn't
you suggest that single physician, single pharmacy dispensing, or are you only talking about those patients who have that history?
For selected patients, we think that can be a very effective intervention.
And how do you find those, then, if they're doctor shopping? Do you find them through the health insurance companies not paying for it, or how do you do this in reality?
Through the prescription drug monitoring programs, through Medicaid programs, through prescription benefits managers. So all of these entities have data on what patients are getting, unless they're self-pay. But most patients are billing the drugs that they're abusing to some insurance system, public or private. So identifying through that and then limiting them for their own good as well as to save money is the right kind of policy.
Thank you. Again, if you have a question, press star 1. Our next question comes from Timothy Martin with Wall Street Journal. You may ask your question.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Could you guys just give a little more color on how you came to the $72.5 billion annual healthcare cost figure?
That's a figure that comes from the insurance industry. There are several different estimates to come up with the healthcare costs. Obviously, you have to include a very small part of it, which is actually the drug, but a much larger part, which is the emergency department visit, hospitalizations, as well as drug treatment admissions and care. Dr. Jones, do you want to say anything more on that?
Sure. So that figure specifically comes from a report that came out in 2007 from the Coalition Against Insurance Fraud. There have been two journal articles that have also looked at costs related to prescription opioid abuse in the past year, and they estimate close to about $55 billion. So we're in the right ballpark of capturing what we assume is the expenditure from the healthcare costs on this issue.
And that last speaker was Dr. Chris Jones, health scientist here at CDC.
Great.
Do you have a follow-up question?
Yeah, just a housekeeping one. So if I heard correctly, I think Dr. Frieden mentioned all but two states have PDMP programs. So that's 48 of the 50 states have them for now.
It was Gil Kerlikowski. I mentioned it, and Missouri and New Hampshire do not have them. I was in New Hampshire last month. There is legislation proposed, and I met with state senators and a state representative. They had several hundred people in an all-day prescription drug summit.
I would also comment that even where there are PDMPs, states are still figuring out how to use them optimally. So the state of Oklahoma, for example, is going to a real-time system so that when opiates are prescribed, they're in the system within 5 minutes. There are other states that are ensuring that doctors see the prescription history as automatically as possible. It's going to a push rather than a pull technology so that they can know very easily if patients are using inappropriately. And other states that are ensuring that pharmacists and not only physicians have access so that they can ensure that that's another window of inappropriate use to close.
Shirley, next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Stephanie Nano with Associated Press. You may ask your question.
Hi. The last question just asked my question. I'm sorry, was it Missouri and New Hampshire that do not have this legislation?
You are correct.
And are they all the same system so that they can cross-reference over state lines, or how does that work?
Well, no, they're not all the same systems, and mm-hmm. I think that's actually one of the important distinctions. It's not a national program.
Mm-hmm.
The states who actually regulate the practice of medicine are able to put into place the laws and the restrictions around patient confidentiality, privacy, et cetera. But we do recommend that the systems be interoperable so that the physician who's or the physician's assistant who may be accessing it in Kentucky and where we were in Appalachia, you have West Virginia, you have Tennessee, and they don't want to, you know, you don't want to burden them with having to make, as Dr. Frieden said, a system in which they have to pull from multiple resources. So, you know, there's a lot of improvement and a lot of work being done from real time to others. But we like the beauty, or I like the beauty, I think, of the system in which the states take responsibility and accountability for this.
There are a lot of differences between states. I'll come back to that in a moment, but Dr. Jones may want to mention an initiative that's just getting underway on this.
Sure. So CDC is involved with the Office of National Drug Control Policy, the Office of the National Coordinator at HHS, as well as SAMHSA, in a set of pilot projects that were initiated this past summer, where we're looking at incorporating prescription drug monitoring program data into real-time practice. And we believe that this will help set up best practices to address some of the differences between the states, but it will also make it where within the physician's daily practice, within the pharmacist, and with the emergency department, the information is right there at their hand. They don't have to go to a separate database to access the information. And we think by incorporating it into their normal workflow will greatly improve the use of the data.
And just to give you a sense of the state-to-state variability, there's a five-fold difference in drug abuse deaths between the lowest and the highest states. And it's if you look at the map, it's quite striking. West Virginia is the second highest in the country at 25.8 opioid deaths per 100,000 population. Right next store in Virginia, the rate is 9.1, one-third the rate, just miles away. So I think this highlights the importance of states getting policies right on prescription drug abuse.
Next question, Shirley.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Joette Giovinco with WTVT. You may ask your question.
Thank you so much. I'm in Tampa, Florida, so I think we are kind of the epicenter of this epidemic, and we've seen so much over the years. But there are a couple of questions that I have. I've recently talked to a judge who does drug court. She says that the law enforcement is working here. We're starting to see decreases in the number of prescription drugs that are out there, but she's seen a shift now to heroin use. And I've also been told because of the prescription drugs here, the people that are cutting the heroin have had to make it much purer because they needed to compete with them. So now there's a concern that we're going to start seeing overdoses from heroin. Is that on your radar screen at all there, or is this just something that's happening here locally with us?
Yes, it is. And I will say that from the standpoint of the Centers for Disease Control, we see the ramifications of prescription drug abuse in many, many different ways. So ranging from infants born to mothers who are on opiates and may be at risk of congenital heart disease to infants born to mothers on opiates who are born addicted to opiate medications to increased risky driving in people who are drugged to increases in hepatitis C and potentially HIV among people who started using prescription opiates and then shifted to heroin, either because it cost less or because they needed to get stronger drugs. And so we're seeing where we had seen for more than a decade steady declines in illnesses associated with injection drug use in several different parts of the country. We're beginning to hear reports of resurgences in the use of injection drug use, specifically heroin, as a continuation of the opiate crisis. So these are serious side effects, serious implications of the epidemic of prescription opiates, and another important argument for why we need to take action now.
And there are two things, this is Gil Kerlikowski, that I'd mention on the heroin. One is that anecdotally across the country, I'm hearing a lot of that same message, that people that either because of the cost of those prescription opiates or because of the fact that availability is being restricted, that they're turning to heroin. The other part that is really incredibly dangerous about is that young people don't have that awareness about, one, prescription drugs, because after all, they are a prescription. But then, two, they have a belief, and I've heard this again anecdotally, that if they just inhale or smoke the heroin, that they won't, in fact, become addicted to that. And, of course, it doesn't turn out to be that much longer before they're actually injecting heroin.
And if I may, I have one more question. I was an occupational medicine physician, so I oversaw some of the drug testing programs in different industries. And synthetic opioids, generally speaking, on a 5-panel, they're not picked up. They're not picked up, generally speaking, in most of the drug testing in workplace communities. Has that ever been a point of discussion, whether or not to add something like that to a panel?
This is Chris Jones. We have seen within the Department of Defense and some other employer drug screening programs a move to include synthetic opioids, predominantly hydrocodone and oxycodone, as well as some of the benzodiazepines, which, as you know, the Valium pathway is typically the one that's picked up for benzodiazepines. So drugs like clonazepam and alprazolam, or which of the most commonly abused benzodiazepines, are not included.
Thank you. Again, if you have a question, press star 1. Our next question comes from Letitia Stein with St. Petersburg Times. You may ask your question.
Yes, thank you so much. You've been highlighting some of the role that states can play, but what of the federal government, which is ultimately responsible for overseeing the manufacture of some of these prescription opiates through the DEA? What could you, working with the CDC and also the administration, be doing to address some of this increase in the supply on the market?
Are you there?
Yes.
I didn't catch all of the last part of the question, but let me tell you that I think the federal government's response. is that particularly the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy has an incredible bully pulpit, the White House. And so by bringing the interagency groups together to talk about this, recognizing it's not just a DEA law enforcement problem, recognizing it's not just a prescriber type of problem, we convened a number of meetings early on. And I'll tell you how I came to this. I've had the job a little over 2 years, and at the time I was being prepared for my confirmation hearing, they said, well, you know that more people are dying as a result of drug overdoses driven by prescription drugs that are dying from gunshot wounds. And in 17 states, of course, greater than car crash deaths. And I said, well, I'm a police chief, and I actually pay attention to what harms people in my community. And you know what? I'm unaware of that. And I said, I bet if I'm unaware, I bet there are an awful lot of other people unaware. And that's exactly the case. So, one, we've really been shouting this from the rooftops, and the administration has been focused on it. The other part is that when we release the national strategy on prescription drugs, the initial funding for these prescription drug monitoring programs is federal funding. There is a center of excellence for the prescription drug monitoring programs where people share their kind of best practices and what makes these things effective. And I think in that strategy you find a huge role and an important role for the federal government, but so much of what will occur to make this problem less of a problem will occur at the state and local level, and that's, again, part of our job. And maybe Dr. Frieden wants to comment.
I'll just say that from our perspective at the CDC, we document the nature and extent and risks for the problem. We help educate healthcare providers in appropriate use of pain relief. We identify and analyze best practices so that communities, localities, and states can determine what path to take. And we support state and local governments in their efforts to implement effective control measures. Obviously, many other parts of the federal government are involved as well. SAMHSA in the treatment aspect, as well as other aspects of drug abuse policy and care, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the Food and Drug Administration, and there is a strong commitment to do what we can do to reduce this as a national problem.
But doesn't the federal government, through the DEA, also authorize how much of these drugs are produced every year so that they can even reach the marketplace in the first place?
We can talk about the quota system, et cetera, but I think there's a clear understanding that just in one particular drug or one particular group of drugs, reducing the total amount that may be produced is not going to be an effective answer to the problem. And the reason is that we don't want to turn the clock back to see people that are in need of these medications not get them. And, of course, the potential in reducing the amount of drugs available could end up resulting in people who become addicted working the system to get them, and the people that actually need them in the proper medication and under the proper supervision would not. So it sounds like a fairly quick answer that could have, we'll just reduce the amount being produced. But we don't really think, given the complexity of the problem, that that's an answer.
Shirley, we have time for questions from two more callers, please.
Thank you. Our next one is from Lisa Garion with LA Times. You may ask your question.
Hi. I heard some talk today about, the problem of these drugs and kids and, cleaning out the medicine cabinets and parents talking to their kids about this problem. And yet the data shows that the overdose deaths is a bigger problem among people in middle ages. Can you talk about what you're doing to address that part of the problem?
Really, it's a wide group of society, but as you note, the highest risk is in the middle-aged population. I think one of the risks that we're seeing is that as more people in that age group have kids, their kids are at risk. As I mentioned earlier, we're already seeing infants born opiate-addicted or at risk of opiate-induced birth defects. But the programs that we're recommending would benefit all who use and potentially abuse opiate drugs by ensuring that when they're necessary, they're provided, and when they're not necessary, they're not provided. Right now, the system is awash in opiates, dangerous drugs that get people hooked and keep them hooked. And by working with states, with provider organizations, with healthcare systems and insurers and others, we can steadily reduce the inappropriate prescription of medications, which will benefit all who are addicted or at risk of being addicted.
Yeah, this is Chris Jones. I just wanted to add that there are simple steps that are recommended in evidence-based guidelines to help identify those patients who may be at risk, and understanding that the 35 to 54 age group is a group that's at risk, we believe that it's important for healthcare providers to screen for substance abuse or mental health history, to use the prescription drug monitoring program to identify if those patients are receiving drugs from other doctors, to use patient-provider agreements and urine drug screens to monitor when patients are on chronic opioid therapy, and to use the quantity that's appropriate for the treatment, for the condition being treated.
Okay, one more question, Shirley.
Thank you. And our final question comes from Christine Moyer with American Medical News. You may ask your question.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. You started answering it at the end of your previous answer. It seems that in some ways this epidemic puts doctors in a difficult position, just because when they're presented with a patient who does have chronic pain, who does need pain relief, it's almost kind of a challenge of what should I be doing now? And you started to touch upon that in your previous answer, but can you offer physicians any other recommendations on how to handle those situations?
I think our overall goal here is to make sure that if we improve how the drugs are prescribed, we can really achieve that balance of making sure that patients have access to effective pain treatment, but also reducing the number of people who are abusing and overdosing. And this is Chris Jones, sorry.
Mm-hmm.
But like I was saying before, it's critical. We know that people with a history of substance use disorder, even if it wasn't specific to prescription painkillers, and people who have mental health disorders are at an increased risk. So screening that, and there are simple screening tools that physicians and other prescribers can use. We believe that if you start the patient on a small amount that seems appropriate for the condition being treated and continue to monitor that patient, you're less likely to have them end up on chronic opioid therapy. Studies have shown that patients who end up on chronic opioid therapy many years later are continuing to be on it. So we want to make sure that we're appropriately treating the condition. Patient-provider agreements, which help the patient and the prescriber set the expectations for the pain treatment and understand that if they're not improving in their functioning or their quality of life, it makes sense to discontinue the opioid. So those are just some of the recommendations, and you'll find those in our materials today.
I think what Dr. Jones points out is that there are a series of tools that physicians can use to maximize palliation without resorting to narcotics, and that ranging from addressing mood disorders to physical therapy to pain relief that does not include narcotics, there are many things that can be done to increase patients' comfort and functionality without risking a lifetime of addiction. I want to thank everyone for joining us today and just recap that we are in the midst of an epidemic of prescription narcotic overdose. The number of overdose deaths now is more than that of heroin and cocaine combined, and that non-medical use of prescription painkillers costs the healthcare system an estimated $70 billion a year, and there are effective measures that can be taken, particularly by states where we have a huge variation in the rate of prescriptions that are provided and the rate of prescription overdoses and overdose deaths. By monitoring better, by taking appropriate action for patients and providers who are using inappropriately, by cracking down on pill mills and doctor shopping and doctors who are prescribing inappropriately, and by promoting good medical practice so that patients who need pain relief get it and patients who don't need narcotics don't get them, by reducing the quantities prescribed, the patients for whom they're prescribed, and the places that they're prescribed in, it's possible to make a big difference and reduce this epidemic and bring it back into controllable levels. So thank you very much Also to Mr. Kurlikowski for your participation. We greatly value the partnership we have, and thanks to all of the staff who worked on this report for an excellent and important piece of research.
Thank you, Shirley. This concludes our call.
Thank you, and this does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation. At this time, you may disconnect your lines.